discussing here a series on the 12 Mahajanas. So today I'll be talking about Narad Muni. We discussed in the previous week about Brahmaji. So this 12 series is based on verse from the 6th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where the 12 Mahajanas are mentioned by Yamaraj, where he talks about 12 illustrious persons who are actually the exemplars of how bhakti is to be practiced. So I had three different ways in which I plan to take this class. Yeah. So, I had three different ways. One was, Narad Muni is the only character who occurs in each canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, apart from Krishna. So, one way of taking this class on Narad Muni could be to talk about his whatever references and incidents which occur in each canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The second way was to talk about him from a biographical perspective, where we start from his childhood and then move forward, not just his childhood actually, because from the Vedic perspective we are not the body, we are the soul. So we start from his previous lives as far as we know, and then we move onwards in a linear chronological way. The third way which we can analyze about Narad Muni is by looking at his character as is depicted in various books. So for example, we can start from the Vedas, then we can move to what all are the references to Narad Muni in the Vedas, then what all are the references to Narad Muni in the Upanishads, then what is the picture of Narad Muni that comes from the various Puranas, then what is the picture, how that differs, or how that picture of Narad Muni is developed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then, you know, a person can be, especially a saint, is best known through his teachings, through his Vani. So Narad Muni has composed two books. One is the Narad Bhakti Sutra and the second is the Narada Smriti. So we could look at these. And in this way we can analyze to understand more about Narad Muni. So I'll take the third approach. The first approach is going over all the 12 cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam. I tried that once in one class on Brahmaji I had taken long ago. I had taken the series of 12 Mahajanas earlier also. So many devotees found it very technical and exhausting going over all the cantos. So of course Narad Muni is, when we talk about Brahma you get into technicalities of creation. Narad Muni is much more, in today's language we could say user friendly. He's much more reader friendly. He is much more into action. But to understand, so linearly we could go also from the biographical point of view. I will go into the biography a little bit, but just to get a broad glimpse of how the Bhagavatam doesn't just, we know the Bhagavatam is the, as Jiva Goswami says, it's Sarva Pramana Chakravarti Bhuta. It is the emperor among all Pramanas. That there are various Pramanas given in scripture and all of them have their importance. But among them, the Bhagavatam is the highest. Because the Bhagavatam gives us the clearest understanding of Krishna, of the absolute truth, not just clearest in terms of the description of who the absolute truth is, but clearest in terms of how we are meant to relate with him with the clearest consciousness, with the most pure consciousness. And what pure love for Bhagavan Sri Krishna is, that is depicted in the Bhagavatam most clearly. So it is not just that the Lord is depicted most clearly, even his intimate devotees are depicted much more clearly in the Bhagavatam than in the other scriptures. So while analyzing the description of Narad Muni in various scriptures, we will also see how his description attains its culmination, its peak, its summit in the Bhagavatam. So, if we look at the Vedas primarily focus on Karmakanda. So in Rig Veda, Narad Muni is described as the composer of one of the famous mantras, which are meant for recitation. The way we use the word mantra, for example, we use the word Hare Krishna Mahamantra. So, we usually talk about mantra as Manas Trayate Iti Mantra, that sound vibration which frees the mind from anxiety, from inebriety, that is mantra. Now, traditionally, there is the understanding that there is Varna, there is Shabda, and there is mantra. So, Varna is letter. Like in English, we have letters. So, Varna is letter. When letters are combined together to form a meaningful unit of thought, that is called as a Shabda. So, for example, you know, if we have a sentence which means something, then there is a semantic unit. But you can just put any set of letters together, and A, Z, Q, L, M, N, O, P, I can put anything together. It doesn't make any sense. So, when something makes semantic sense, that is called as Shabda. But, now, within the English framework, or within not just the English language is 800 years old, within the Greco-Latin framework from which English emerged, now anything that does not have semantic meaning, anything does not have meaning, it is considered to be meaningless. But mantra is a combination of varna, whose potency is not in its meaning. Its potency is in its arrangement itself. A mantra, of course, it has some meaning, but we don't need to understand the meaning of the mantra to get its potency. It's like if somebody makes a joke, then that joke is made in a language which we don't understand. Then we will understand that everybody is laughing, some joke is going on, we will not understand anything. But the mantra, its potency does not depend on semantic comprehension. We don't have to understand the mantra. So, composing mantras in that sense is far more difficult, because coherent sentences can be composed, but to understand which sound vibrations are having that divine potency and to combine them together to create a mantra, that requires very special potency. So, of course, Narad Muni has that potency. And if we look at the Vedas talk about mantras, and their primary focus is, say, mantras are tools for elevating towards heaven. That is the Vedic understanding. Then from the Vedas, we move towards the Upanishads. I'm going a little fast because our focus will be on the Puranas and the Bhagavatam. The Upanishads are primarily metaphysical treatises. That means, rather than trying to do things, no, karma means I want to do this, I want to do that. You run around and do a lot of things. So the Upanishads are for jnana. Okay, what is the use of doing so many things? Ultimately, everything is temporary. Think about what is the ultimate purpose of life. So the Upanishads focus more on metaphysical discourse, on trying to understand what is the ultimate purpose of life. And one of the characteristics of the Upanishads are custom made for people who are intellectuals, or people who think that they are intellectuals. So for such people, if you give things simply, they'll say, this is too simple. You know, so for example, if you tell them, you are not the body, you are the soul. I've heard it so many times. Tell them, your destiny is greater than your biology. Hey, what's that? It means the same thing. Your destiny is greater than your biology. It means the same thing, you are not your body. But when you put it like this, your destiny is greater than your biology. You have to think what it means. And if people like to think, so Radha Krishna are the divine couple. I know it all. Radha and Krishna represent the primordial cosmological masculine and feminine principles. Oh. So, the Upanishads specialize in catering to intellectuals. And for catering to intellectuals, they often speak things in paradoxes. Paradox is different from contradiction. Contradiction means two things are opposite. You know, you are wrong, no, I am right. That's a contradiction. But paradox is where there are two contradictory statements,
which are brought together to convey a deeper truth.
So, for example, in English, say, a teacher may tell to students, the least corrected paper is the most correct.
The least corrected paper, the paper on which there are the least red marks. The least corrected paper is the most correct. Now, initially, how can the least corrected be most correct? We not understand. But if you think, then we understand. So, like that, the Upanishads speak, for example, the Ishopanishads books.
Tad ejati, tad naijati, tad dure, tad antike, tad antarasya sarvasya, tadu sarvasyasya bahayataha.
That absolute truth can run and can move, can't move. It's inside everything, outside everything. You know, he is close and he's far away. And we say, how is this possible? Then they get some intellectuals get some food for thought. When they get some food for thought, then they feel there's something exciting over here. So Narada Muni, within the Upanishads, in the Upanishads, there are various dialogues. So there are great sages who are invited by the kings to come assemble, and then they have discussions on various topics. So Narada Muni within the Upanishads features as a superstar intellectual. He is a person who bamboozles others by his intellectual gymnastics. And we see this, a glimpse of this, even in the Bhagavatam, where he speaks, he instructs the sons of Daksha Prajapati through enigmatic, riddle-like instructions. That is described in the Bhagavatam. So, the point is that for whoever is in whichever category, Narada Muni gives instructions accordingly. So, the Upanishads are more for intellectual speculators, and Narada Muni gives instructions accordingly over there. And then, if we look at the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and then we'll come to the Upanishads, into the Bhagavatam. If we get time, we'll look at Narada Bhakti Sutra towards the end. In the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata, actually Vyasadeva appears much more prominently than the than Narada Muni. But let's look at him appearing in the Ramayana. In the Ramayana, his role is foundational. Because it is by his inspiration that Valmiki gets the purity and the motivation to compose the Ramayana. We know Valmiki is the composer of the Ramayana. And Valmiki was earlier a bandit, a dacoit. And it is by Narada Muni's instruction, inspiration. Narada Muni, a preacher has to be resourceful. You have to present according to time, place, circumstance. If a preacher doesn't do that, then people will not be able to relate. So, for example, now the Valyagodi is so contaminated by sin that he's not able to chant the name of Ram also. So, what does Narada Muni tell him? Chant. Can't chant Ram, you chant Maram, 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 Ram. It's going round and round, it becomes Ram. So, this is what Rupa Goswami tells, has told 500 years ago, that the responsibility, that the basic principle of sadhana bhakti is, yena kena prakarena mana Krishna niveshayet. Somehow or the other, fix the mind on Krishna. So, this principle is illustrated by Narada Muni here, when he is change the name of Mara. Mara is actually the god of death, but just changing that round, just chanting Mara Mara, makes it Ram Ram Ram. So, Srila Prabhupada also exhibited such expertise, you know, in presenting bhakti according to time, place, circumstance. Once he was giving a class in the Lower East Side in New York. There was people who were often, you know, when they would come for the classes also, at that time there was no temple, and even if there had been a temple with deities, people had no idea of the sanctity of the deities over there. So they would just come, maybe they had just taken drugs. Drugs were always available all the time. So they had taken drugs and then they would come to the temple, and they would be in a half dozens, half dazed and half dozed stage. So they would, and one of them, such hippie, asked Prabhupada, Swamiji, what is Vaikuntha like? So now Prabhupada could have spoken, Chintamani Prakara Sadma Shukalpa Vruksha. He said, oh, there are so many desire trees, and there are, now this is things people do not have comprehended. So what did Prabhupada say? Vaikuntha is like an ocean of LSD.
Vaikuntha is like an ocean of LSD. Now, nowhere in scripture is it said that Vaikuntha is like an ocean of LSD. Somebody wants to be a fault finder, you say, this is aparad. How can you compare Vaikuntha to a drug? But the point is, you know, if there had been hypercritical people at the time of Narad Muni, they could have found fault in Narad Muni also. Who has told to chant the name of Mara, Mara, Mara? But the point is, the expertise of the preacher is to present bhakti according to time, place, circumstance. So Narad Muni, if he told him to chant Mara, 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 and it became Ram, 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 and Valmiki became purified. And then Valmiki got an inspiration that, I want to know, my character was so debauched and my character got transformed. So, is there any person who is of ideal character? And if there is such a person, what was his character? What are his qualities? What were his activities? So he asked this question to his guru Narad Muni. And then Narad Muni at that time tells him about Lord Ram. And in that, in a very brief description, in summary, he gives of the entire Ram Leela. And based on that summary, then Valmiki Rishi enters into a trance. It's a long story how from Shoka comes a Shloka. Now, from his grief at having uttered an accidental curse, he gets a meter of the Ramayana and then he composes the whole Ramayana over there. So, Narad Muni is the source from which Ramayana manifests in this world. Now, within the Ramayana itself, also Narad Muni appears at various times. One of the most significant times where he appears is right in the beginning. In the Ramayana, we have it starts from Balakanda where the Lord Ram appears and the backstory a little bit is given. But in the last kanda of Valmiki Ramayana, the Uttar Kanda, where after everything has happened, then Narad Muni again visits Lord Ram when he is in his palace. And at that time, Narad Muni and the other sages who are accompanying him, they felicitate Lord Ram for his glorious victory over Ravana. And then Ram asks him that how is it that Ravana was so powerful? How was Indrajit so powerful? And at that time, the various stories of Ravana, what all earlier he had done, they are told. So that means, here we will see that there are three levels which Narad Muni is present in the Ramayana. Not three incidents, three levels. First is, it is by his inspiration that Ramayana is coming. Now, within the Ramayana, he is a character who is narrating the story. And while narrating the story, he is a character in the story also. So, how is that? He tells the story. One of the stories is, Ravana, he goes around, after he gets boons from Brahma and Shiva, he's going around terrorizing the universe. And as he's terrorizing the universe, he's especially terrorizing the humans. Because he feels that I can inflict as much damage as possible on people. So at that night, Narad Muni comes over there. And now there are different narratives in different Puranas. This refer to different kalpas. So what happened at different kalpas? So first when he sees Narad Muni, now Narad Muni is, you know, he's having his veena and he's chanting the names of Lord Narayan. And he says, hey, this is a devotee of Narayan. So he's initially a little angry. So he just beckons him, go away. Narad Muni doesn't go away at that time. And according to one retelling of the Ramayana, actually, Ravana attacks Narad Muni. And he finds to his amazement that all his arrows, they just disappear into Narad Muni's body, nothing happens. And Ravana starts thinking, what is this? You know, I have overpowered the Devatas, and this is a sage, he doesn't even have a weapon. And still I am being defeated. Then, Narad Muni is also expert, so he says that he has to earn the respect of Ravana in a way which Ravana will respect. So Ravana is not a sage, is not going to respect wisdom, but he respects prowess. Then Ravana comes along, Ravana tells Narad Muni, please come in. He offers him a seat in his chariot and he says, you know, please tell me, how is it that none of my arrows hurt you? What is your secret? Can you share it with me? He says, yes. It's no problem. You know, you cannot kill me because I have a spiritual body. He says, can I get a spiritual body also? He says, yes. Just chant the name of Narayan. He says, that is impossible for me. I can't do that. So, then Narad Muni is in his own saintly, calm way. He says, so what are you doing? He says, I am finding my next shikar. You know, whom should I kill next? So he says, Narad Muni says that all these humans, you know, they are like mosquitoes. Why are you fighting with them? Don't waste your time with them. If you really want to exhibit your prowess, go and attack the god of death. Go and attack Yamaraj. If you can attack Yamaraj and you can defeat and kill Yamaraj, then that will be a glorious victory for you. No, everybody is afraid of death, but you will have defeated death itself. So, Ravana says, very good idea. He says, I'll go immediately. Now, I'll address this theme a little later. Narad Muni, in some Puranic narratives, he is called as Kalaha Priya. Kalaha Priya is one who likes to create quarrels. In fact, just a few days ago, there was in Indian headlines, I don't know, probably first time, Narad Muni may have come on the front page. So there was one politician from one political party accused another politician from another political party that don't be like Narad Muni. So he was crazy. This politician was trying to create a dissension between the top rung leaders of this party as well as the lower rung leaders. Just don't be like Narad Muni. So the idea is that Narad Muni creates conflicts. But this is such a oversimplified understanding of things. It is oversimplification to the point of error. Yes, Narad Muni does set up situations where conflicts are either accelerated or aggravated. That means conflicts occur faster or conflicts become tougher. But the point is not that conflicts occur. The point is what is the purpose served by conflicts. So, in this case, what happens is, Ravana, anyway, he had that misdirected Kshatriya zeal. A Kshatriya is Kshatatrayate, one who protects others from hurt. That is actually a Kshatriya. But when a Kshatriya is Kshatriya zeal is misdirected, then one gets delight in hurting others. One gets delight in overpowering and oppressing others. So he already had that zeal, and anyway, he was not going to stop. So better direct him against someone who, by fighting with whom he will incur bad karma, because he is disrupting the universal order, and with whom he will not be able to very easily defeat also. So that way he will be engaged in the battle for a longer time, and that way he will not cause havoc elsewhere in the world. So that is the purpose. And we will see when we come to the Mahabharata how Narad Muni actually plays a significant role in avoiding Kalaha also. But here, so Ravana goes out and he goes to the lower planets. Now, Yamaraj is the ruler of Narakloka. He doesn't live in Narakloka. His abode is celestial and others cannot even access his abode. So, when Ravana finds that he just goes around and he's not able to see Yamaraj's abode anywhere. So, he starts attacking the residents of Yamloka, the Yamadutas and the prisoners who are suffering over there. And by wreaking havoc over there, he tries to provoke Yamaraj to come. And it's a long story. Yamaraj and he has a very, very fierce fight. And finally Yamaraj is so furious at the disruption that he's creating, Yamaraj is about to use his weapon to kill him. But at that time Brahmari appears and tells him that, I have given him benediction. Please don't kill him right now. Later on, he will be killed. So then Yamaraj disappears. And Ravana becomes all the more inflated. He says, oh, Yamaraj also fled away from me. Actually, Yamaraj had not fled away, but Yamaraj had been requested by Brahmaji to go. So by increasing his ego, then when his ego increases like this, eventually he, even after he knows that Ram has single-handedly killed 14,000 of his warriors, still he tries to abduct Sita. And thus he courts his own destruction. So this is a story, story which is told by Narad Muni later about Ravana in the Uttarkhand of the Ramayana. Now if we move on to the Mahabharata. In the Mahabharata, Narad Muni's student Vyasadev is present much more. He keeps appearing frequently because for many reasons. One of the main reasons is Vyasadev is directly related with the protagonists also. You know, Vyasadev is the grandfather of both the Kauravas and the Pandavas. So now Narad Muni appears on a few occasions. One of the most significant occasions when Narad Muni appears in the Mahabharata is after the Pandavas are married. So in the Swayamvar, Arjuna wins Draupadi, and then we all know the story about how Kunti tells Yudhishthira, whatever you have got, you should share it. And the Pandavas are alarmed. He said, how can we share? And they, it's just Kunti just speaks it casually and she has complete silence. Then she turns around and he says, she has got a bride. Then they all start thinking. At that time, Vyasadeva appears. And then there's a lot of discussion between them and Draupada. And finally, they told that in the previous life, Draupadi had prayed to Mahadev that she wanted a husband. And when Mahadev appeared, she had been performing austerities for so long that when Mahadev appeared in her desperate eagerness, she said, I want a husband, I want a husband, I want a husband, I want a husband, I want a husband. She said 5 times. So Lord Shiva said, you will have 5 husbands in your next life. So now because of this, so now Vyasadeva tells this story. And then Draupadi, when this story is told, then Draupada's anxiety is relieved. And then she gets married to all 5 of them. Now after this marriage, so at this time the Pandavas in exile, this is before they are put in exile, after the gambling match. Prior to that, when they had been taken to Varnavart and their palace had been burnt, then they had gone to exile once. So then, when they get married, when the Pandavas, they get married to Draupadi, at that time Dhritarashtra recognizes, oh, that now Draupada is a very powerful king. And the Draupadas, the Panchalas and Kurus were traditionally rivals. And he's concerned that if Pandavas are allied with the Panchalas may attack and overrun us completely. So he decides to give half the kingdom. And of course he gives the deserted Khandavaprastha. By Krishna's mercy, they make it Indraprastha. So at that time, when they just come to their palace back, Narad Muni comes over there. And what does Narad Muni instruct the Pandavas? No, Narad Muni is a great sage. He's coming to the house of some householders. He may talk about detachment. He may talk about devotion. No, he talks about something eminently practical. And he says that he starts telling about a story of 2 great demons, Sunda and Upasunda. And he says that these 2 demons, they had done a lot of austerity and they had got a benediction from Brahma that no, they would not be killed by anyone except each other. So Sunda would be killed by Upasunda and Upasunda will be killed by Sunda. And they were the best of friends. They were brothers and friends. So there was no possibility that they would fight against each other and kill each other. And they were undefeatable, working havoc in the universe. And all the devatas went to Brahmaji, and then Brahmaji told, he said that this is a problem. He said, I'll make a solution. So at that time, Brahmaji created Apsara. Her name was Tilottama. And this is Apsara appeared in front of Sunda and Upasunda. And as soon as both of them saw her, so Sunda said, oh, she will be my wife and your sister. He said, no, she will be my wife, your sister. And both of them started fighting. So Tilottama was just sitting there, watching there, smiling, and both of them fought and fought and they killed each other. With one blow, both of them hit each other and killed each other. So, this story is being told by Narad Muni to the Pandavas. And Narad Muni tells them that, you know, those demons were undefeatable, but they were killed because of such a quarrel. He says, oh, you, now, the implication was clear for the Pandavas, and the Pandavas became very grave. And he says, you are 5 brothers who are the best of friends. But don't think that your friendship will stay as it is. You have to have clear policy, clear plan of how you are going to make this marriage work. Now sometimes, so I, based on this whole past time, we can't go into the whole past time. In Columbus, I gave a whole class on cooperation among equals. You know, if you have to cooperate among equals, it is not that just because we are all equals, we will be able to cooperate. Or it's just because, you know, we are equal. If whatever I do, he will understand, she will understand. It's not like that. You know, when any particular, I don't want to use here to And there's no objectification of women over here. There's a principle being talked about over here. That when any resource is being shared, there has to be clear policies about how it is to be done. And we see here that we may say this is a very private affair for the Pandavas. How they deal with their wife. And why is Narad Muni coming and interfering over there? But the point is, it is so serious that it has to be dealt with in an appropriate way. So we may be working in a particular service and we may have to share particular resources. So at that time, you know, we can't just say, he will understand. No, we have to have clear policies by which things will be understood clearly, not that we assume others understand. So Narad Muni here, what he does is, far from creating conflict, he anticipates and prevents conflict. And the Pandavas also take it very seriously. So seriously, in fact, basically they say that when Draupadi is with one of her husbands, the other husbands should not go there. They should have private time for them. So at one time when Arjuna, when Draupadi is with Yudhishthir, and at that time a Brahmin comes and says, my fire sacrifice paraphernalia has been stolen by thieves. So Arjuna has to get his weapons to chase after them, and the weapons are in that room where Draupadi and Yudhishthira are together. So at that time Arjuna doesn't know what to do. So Arjuna knocks on the door, goes inside. Yudhishthira and Draupadi are talking. Yudhishthira smiles. He explains the situation. And then he takes the arrow, bow and arrow, goes out, chases the thieves, gives back the lost property to the Brahmana, and then he comes back and he tells Arjuna, Arjuna tells Yudhishthira that, you know, I have violated the condition, so I will now go to exile for 1 year. Yudhishthira and Draupadi both are shocked. He says, no, you don't have to go. We understand, this is an exception. He said, no exceptions. He says, I have to go. Yudhishthira says, no, actually this rule, Yudhishthira actually gives various arguments over there. And he says that, no, actually this rule is for if an older brother comes to his younger brother. You know, for you are like my son. A son can always come where the mother and father are there together. He says, no problem. He says, no. Arjuna says, no, I will go. So the point is, Narad Muni, here, he comes in a role where he is anticipating and preventing conflicts. Of course, Narad Muni comes at several other places also in the Mahabharata. But let's move on to the Bhagavatam now. So, now the Bhagavatam is Amala Puran. And Jiva Goswami has written a set of books called the Shat Sandarbhas. And in the Shat Sandarbhas, he analyzes the Bhagavatam and places the various conversations and themes in the Bhagavatam in a systematic framework. So, in his analysis of the Bhagavatam, so he says that the Bhagavatam has various seeds from which it emerges. So, normally we think of the Bhagavatam as a conversation between Shukadev Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj. And that is, yes, that is the essence of the Bhagavatam, we can say. That is one level from which the Bhagavatam emerges. Another is what starts the Bhagavatam. So actually the conversation between Shukadev Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj starts from the last few verses of the first canto, 19th chapter. And Shukadev Goswami speaks for the first time in the first verse of the first chapter of the second canto. And he ends off in the fifth chapter of the 12th canto. So the subsequent chapters after the 5th chapter and all the 19 chapters of the 1st canto, they are actually another conversation. They are a conversation between Suta Goswami and the sages of Naimisharanya, headed by Shaunak Rishi. So we could say that is another seed of the Bhagavatam. So one seed is from the 2nd canto to the 12.5. Another is from the 1st canto, 1st chapter to the last canto, last verse. Not exactly 1st canto, 1st verse, because there are some invocation verses before it starts off. But another, from the conceptual point of view, so this is from the chronological, the historical point of view. Where was the Bhagavatam spoken first? But from the conceptual point of view, the Bhagavatam emerges through the instruction of Narad Muni to Vyasadeva. This is described in the Narada Vyasa Samvad in the 4th, 5th and 6th chapters of the 1st canto. And in this Narada Vyasa Samvad, actually Narad Muni describes to Vyasadeva how he should glorify the Supreme Lord, use all his abilities, his phenomenal intellectual literary abilities to glorify the Supreme Lord.
The fourth canto is sets the scene that Vyasa, the fourth chapter of the first canto, it sets the scene that Vyasadeva has systematically composed all the Vedic literature, putting them into written form, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Puranas, including the Mahabharata. It's phenomenal intellectual work he has done. And yet after that, he's feeling dissatisfied. And at that time, he is thinking, what could be the cause of my dissatisfaction? He says, I've been disciplined, I've been dedicated, I have written all this literature. What could be the cause? And he starts suspecting his heart, probably, is it that I did not glorify the Supreme Lord enough? As he's thinking like this, at that time Narad Muni appears over there. And Narad Muni confirms to Vyasadeva. Now it's interesting that normally when two people meet each other, they may ask, how are you, what are you doing, how are things going on? So Narad Muni is very properly received by Vyasadeva, washes his feet, offers him a seat of honor. But the first thing that Narad Muni asks, when he starts speaking, it's a rhetorical question. And the essence of that question is, are you satisfied by identifying the body and the mind as the objects of self-realization? So are you satisfied by identifying the body and the mind as the objects of self-realization? That means you have provided all this knowledge which is actually catering to the body and the mind. It is not catering to the soul. How can you be satisfied with that? So then he gives him beautiful instructions about how you should direct all your energies for glorifying the Supreme Lord. Idam hi pumsa tapasa shutasyava svishtasya suptasya cha buddhi dattayo avichyutartha kavibhi nirupito yad uttam shloka gunanuvarananam. Is whatever branch of knowledge one might be studying in, yad uttam shloka gunanuvarananam, it all should be used to glorify uttam shloka. The Lord who is glorified by choice verses, we should also glorify Him using our talents. And that is the purpose and perfection of all our abilities. Maybe 1.5-2 years ago, one of the world's most famous comedians, Robin Williams, he committed suicide. So at that time it created a shock in the world, because he was a comedian. He's a person who's supposed to make everyone laugh, and he was expert at making people laugh. So why did he commit suicide? So at that time I had written an article about it called After the Laughter. So after the laughter, on the screen, on the comedy shows, we may see him laughing, we may see him causing others laugh. But what happens after the laughter? Normally we think if a person is laughing a lot, that person is happy. Yes, it's possible that person may be happy. But, the ability to crack jokes, the ability to be humorous, is also a material ability. It's just like some people can sing nicely, some people can speak eloquently, some people can write very beautifully. Like that, some people can crack jokes. So just that, because somebody's handwriting is very good, that doesn't mean that person is happy. Isn't it? It's just a skill that the person has. So now this we can very easily understand, because we see it's a very separate skill. Okay, your hands have a particular skill by which you can write nicely. But when we think about humor, when we see somebody who is humorous, we think, oh, this person must be happy. But the capacity to be humorous is also just a skill. It's a skill that some people get by their past karma. And some people may have it more, some people may have it less. And like all skills, whatever skill one has, one can develop it. But just because one has the capacity to be humorous, that does not mean that one will be happy. So it's just a skill which one can use for becoming famous, for earning a living, for gaining prestige, whatever. But it's different from happiness. Happiness comes when we glorify the Supreme Lord. Yad uttama shloka gunanuvarananam. And there, actually this chapter, Narad Muni, he gives beautiful instructions. He says that just as if a boat does not have an anchor, it will always be shaken by the waves that will come in the ocean.
similarly, that a mind that is not anchored in God, that will always be restless. Vata ahat. By wind, when a boat is afflicted, it will always be shaking. So like that, the mind that is not sheltered in God, that will always be restless. And therefore, the duty of you, O great sage, he says, Mahanubhava. Narad Muni refers to Vyasdeva very respectfully as Mahanubhava. He says, what should you do? He says, Samadhina Anusmara Vicheshtitam. Samadhina. Go into Samadhi, Anusmara. Remember. Vicheshtitam. Vicheshtitam is the glorious activities of the Supreme Lord. And describe those activities. So, after speaking these instructions, wherein Narad Muni tells, so Vyasadeva has this intuition from within. Yes, I have not glorified the Supreme Lord. And Narad Muni comes and confirms that intuition. So normally, when we start practicing spiritual life, initially we have our spiritual guides and we may ask everything to our spiritual guides. You know, what should I do in this situation? What should I not do in this situation? But as we start moving onwards in our spiritual life, Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantite. Krishna gives intelligence by which how we can come towards Him. And the voice of conscience starts speaking from within. But still, when we have to make major decisions in our life, we shouldn't just depend on the inner voice, but we should also look at and consult our spiritual guides. But here we see this harmony of the inner voice, inner guiding voice and the outer guiding voice. So Vyasadeva has been serving sincerely, and when he's been serving sincerely, he starts feeling, this is what is missing, this is what I am not doing enough. Maybe I have to focus on this more. And he talks to the spiritual guides, and spiritual guides also confirm, yeah, this is what you should do. In our life, we all struggle to balance things. You know, we live in a culture that wherein our lives are overstressed, overscheduled, overworked. We have just too many things to do. And so the only way that we can do things is by one of the ways, not only way. It's like if we have to go for a journey and we are going to carry one suitcase. It's a big suitcase. If you try to fit our whole house into the suitcase, we can't fit it in. It's just not possible. So like that, if we try to do everything that we want to do or everything that others tell us we should do, it's just not going to fit in 24 hours. So we have to prioritize. And that prioritization, when we want to balance, often we think, you know, I want to balance, okay, morning I will do this, afternoon I will do this, evening I will do this, then I will do this. Like this, we try to plan, okay, this is what I will do, this. And you think this sort of plan looks very good on paper. But once we start coming to real life, it just, all the plans seem to just, every day we find not the plan working, a new reason for the plan getting disrupted. That is what we find. And sometimes we may just give up planning. But actually, plans may not work, but planning works. Plans means, especially, this is what I'll do, this is what I'll do, this is what I'll do. If you try to do like that, it may not work. Because we are not really in control. But still, planning gives us an overall sense of direction in our life. So, if we expect a static balance, that means we want to make our life like a formula. I'll do this, then I'll do this, then I'll do this, then I'll do this. It will not work. What we need for life is not static balance, but dynamic balance. Dynamic balance means, let's suppose somebody is riding a cycle. And if you're going on a cycle, and then you want to turn right. At that time, normally when a cycle, the balance state is a vertical state. But if I want to turn right, the balance state is the tilted state, the right tilted state. But after I have turned right, if I still stay tilted, then I'll go around in a circle. So after I have turned right, then again I have to become vertical. And even if I want to go straight and there is no road over there or there's a traffic jam over there, then I turn right, then again I'd have to turn left. At that time, I have to tilt towards the left. And after tilting towards the left, again I have to become vertical. Then again turn towards the left and then I'll be on the right track back again. So, just as in a cycle when we are going, at that time, it's a dynamic balance. So, you may have to turn left. We have to go in this direction, but sometimes you have to turn left, sometimes you have to turn right. Sometimes when the road is clear, we'll go fast. Sometimes we'll go slow. But overall, the direction is there and we keep moving. So like that, planning, it doesn't tell us, planning won't tell us the details of what we should do. But planning at least gives a direction of where we need to go in our life. And this is focused, centered on recognizing that the creativity, the principle that that Narad Muni tells Vyasadeva in chapters 5 and 6, especially his instructions, that is, the creativity of the creature is meant for the creator. The creativity, all our abilities that are there, of the creature, we are all creatures, the creativity is not to be rejected. We have abilities, they are not to be rejected. But the creativity of the creature is meant for the creator. Svakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. What Krishna tells to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita? Svakarmana, by your work, worship him. Tam abhyarcha, you worship him. Siddhim vindati manava. In this way, one will attain perfection. So this is Narad Muni in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Where he, so I was talking that this is the conceptual seed of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Chapters 4, 5, 6 are the conceptual seed. And based on this seed, then the chapter 7 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, of the first canto, there it described that Vyasadeva sits in meditation. And then when he sits in meditation, so at that time he gets a vision. Apashyat purusham purnam mayam chitadapashrayam. He sees how the Supreme Person is in control and Maya is under his control. So there are 5 verses which describe Vyasadeva's vision. And from that vision, he expands the full Srimad Bhagavatam. So in this sense, Narad Muni is also the seed of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because he gives the conceptual vision, from which he gives the conceptual understanding, from which comes the mystical vision of Vyasadeva. And from that mystical vision, comes the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, after that, there are practically each canto we have Narad Muni coming. In the second canto, Narad Muni asks Brahmaji that... Brahmaji is Narad Muni's father, and he asks him, you know, that you created the world and therefore you must be the supreme, but I see that you also meditate on someone, so whom do you meditate on? And here Narad Muni is taking the role of a seeker and is asking the questions, and then Brahmaji, he says, yes, I appreciate that illusory energy because of which you think I am the creator. So he doesn't chastise Narad Muni directly, but indirectly he says, you are an illusion. You are an illusion. So then Narad Muni and Vyasadeva, through this Narad Muni and Brahmaji, through this conversation, they bring about the glory of the Supreme Lord, about how Brahma is not a supreme, but Vishnu is the supreme. The second canto is often called as it's titled often as Creating the Creator. You know, it is the creator, Brahmaji is secondary creator, the primary creator is Vishnu. So, like that in the third canto also, there's a reference to Narad Muni, but I'll focus on the fourth canto now. I'll talk, from the Bhagavatam, I'll talk about 3 main incidents. I'll talk on the fourth canto, seventh canto and tenth canto, I'll talk about a few things. So, in the fourth canto, Narad Muni appears several times. You know, he appears in the Prachini Parishad, Prachini Pari pastime also. But I'll focus on the Dhruva pastime. Now, the story of Dhruva Maharaj is extraordinary for many reasons. One of the main reasons is that how normally when a mother sees her child crying, and the natural maternal instinct is to console the child. And Suniti, when she sees Dhruva crying, you know, he's not just crying, he's sobbing. He's devastated to have been rejected, to have been castigated by his mother and by his stepmother, and neglected by his father. He's coming in tears. You know, there is Suniti, you know, when she sees her son crying like this, you know, her heart is shattered. But at the same time, it requires intelligence to acknowledge that some things are beyond our power. Now she doesn't try to console him and tell everything will be alright. She says that actually if you want to solve this problem, she just tries to console him. She says, no, Dhruva is angry and he says, I want a kingdom bigger than my father's. How can I get it? So then his mother, she tells him that only Lord Vishnu can give it to you.
She says, where can I find Lord Vishnu? Now we don't know whether Dhruva Maharaj's mother, when she was answering this question, she really expected Dhruva will suddenly go to the forest. Just a child is crying and a child comes to the mother. And he says, oh Vishnu, I have heard a sages go to the forest in search of Vishnu. And Dhruva just wipes off his tears and walks out. And he doesn't even speak to his mother. His mother must be shocked in that time. But she doesn't stop him. She sees that he has the determination. And she blesses him. So then, this is such an extraordinary act of courage. Not only from Dhruva. Yes, Dhruva is courageous at the age of 5 going out of the forest. But even his mother, to let go of a son like that. He goes, and Narad Muni has his ESP, extrasensory perception. He's able to see whatever, wherever there is an extraordinary action happening, Narad Muni is there. So Narad Muni comes to know that Dhruva has gone to the forest like this, all alone. Then he goes to the forest. And he goes to the forest and he comes right in the path of Dhruva. And Dhruva sees, oh, this is a sage. And his mother has taught him some culture. He says, when sages are, they should be respected. So he offers the respect to Narad Muni. And Narad Muni sweetly asks him, oh, Dhruva, what are you doing in this forest all alone? He says, I am searching for Vishnu. Oh, what do you want to do with Vishnu? And Narad Muni is basically playfully talking with him initially. What do you want to do with Vishnu? He says, I want to find Vishnu. Because, he says, why do you want? He says, because I want a kingdom bigger than my father's. So, he says, why, what happened? Then Dhruva is still very angry. Still, he tells the whole story. And then Narmuni says, hey, Dhruva, you're just a small child right now. These austerities are performed by people when they grow older. Anyway, he's your father only. He did not mean anything bad to you. Just go back home now. So, Dhruva says, you know, Narad Muni, if you can tell me how to find Vishnu, please tell me. Otherwise, please let me go ahead. So, then Narad Muni tries another attack. He says, actually, yes, I see that you are not just a child. You know, you are grown up. If you are truly grown up, then if you are a child, no, you should not. Parents may chastise sometimes. Children don't take it very seriously. And if you are grown up, then you should be spiritually mature. And actually, you should be beyond in honor and dishonor. So Narad Muni tries to checkmate Dhruva. If you are a small child, go back home. If you are grown up, go back home. If you are grown up, truly grown up, then you should be beyond honor and dishonor. So go back home. So now Dhruva is very respectful. But at the same time, he's very firm. He says that, oh Narad Muni, the instructions that you are giving are true. But they find no place in my heart. I cannot follow them. Because I am the Kshatriya blood within me. That I cannot tolerate this dishonor. And at that time, Narad Muni, is before this actually, when Narad Muni hears that Dhruva has left home. At that time, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam which says, Narad Muni speaking this verse, Aho Kshatriya Tejasam Man Bhangam Amrishyatam. He says, just see the glory of the Kshatriyas, that they cannot tolerate dishonor. Now we may say, is that really a glory? To not tolerate dishonor? We say, we should, Amanina Manadena Trunadapi Sunichena. We should tolerate all insults. That's what we say. We should not expect respect. We should give all respect. We should be humbler than a blade of grass. Then he says, what is this? Why is Narad Muni saying that how glorious they are that they cannot tolerate insult? There are two distinct concepts which should not be conflated. Now there is honor and there is arrogance. Arrogance means that we crave for respect from others. And when we don't get the respect from others, we become vituperative, we become vicious, we become malicious, we become destructive. So arrogance is undesirable. But in contrast, there is honor. Honor is something very different. Honor is not exactly pride. And we usually talk about the six anarthas. Lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, anger and illusion. So now, if you see, the words also have different meanings in different cultural contexts.
So nowadays the word pride often has positive connotations. You may have a hotel pride, hotel executive pride. You may have that. Now at least I have not seen any hotel arrogance. Like, arrogance is understood to be a negative quality. But pride is often seen as a positive quality. So for example, suppose there is a cricket series going on, say 5-match series, and say one team loses all the first 3 matches. Today is the 3rd match between Australia and India, so maybe because of this less people are here. So suppose India loses the 3rd match also, so all 3 matches are lost. Then what they say is, the series is lost, but we will play for pride. So we'll play for pride means at least we don't want a 5-0 scoreline. Although the series is lost, but still we want to acquit ourselves at least at some respectable level. So the point which I am making is that the word pride does not always have the negative connotation of arrogance. So Radhanath Maharaj in his book Journey Home, when I was editing that book for him, so I noticed that when he talks about the 6 anarthas, he translates mother, he doesn't translate it as ahankar, he doesn't translate that as pride, he translates that as arrogance. Then I asked Maharaj about it. Maharaj said that pride is considered to be a very good thing normally. So when we are talking to new people, if they say we should not have any pride, they use the word pride in the sense of honor. Honor means what? That now Prabhupada also talks about honor. Say for example, if somebody has taken initiation vow, and then some devotee did not follow the initiation vow. So Prabhupada wrote a letter to them. Don't you have any sense of honor? You have taken a vow in front of the spiritual master. You have taken a vow in front of the deities. You have taken a vow in front of the sacred fire. How can you not follow your vow? How can you not honor the vow that you have taken in front of it? So, when we talk about honor, honor is what enables people to act honorably. Now, if people don't have a sense of honor, then they will do anything and everything just for their selfish interests. But when people have a sense of honor, then there are certain things which they will not do. Because their own conscience, their own sense of honor will not let them do those things. So in that sense, if honor enables us to act honorably, honor impels us to act honorably, then that is not undesirable. So here, when we see that Narad Muni is telling Dhruva, Narad Muni is appreciating, Aho Kshatriya Tejasam Mana Bhangam Amrishyatam. How glorious are the Kshatriyas that they are not able to tolerate dishonor. What does it mean? We see, yes, when they are dishonored, they are not able to tolerate it. But what do they do when they are dishonored? It is not that Dhruva Maharaj is going on a rampage. He is not, I am going to have a blood feud against my stepmother and her son. He displaced me from a throne, so I am going to kill him. Nothing like that. What he does is, if one has a sense of honor and then one is dishonored, that dishonor impels one to seek recourse by honorable means. So what does he do? He worships Vishnu. And it is because of that sense of honor that he is so determined. He says, I have to correct this wrong. So Narad Muni appreciates him over there. And when here Dhruva says that what you are telling, I cannot do this. So here, usually we talk about the spiritual master and disciple, the guru-shishya relationship as vertical. Spiritual master gives instruction and the disciple follows. Yes, that is true. But it is not just a vertical relationship in the sense of one way. It is actually a bilateral relationship. The disciple also speaks to the spiritual master. Disciple also shares one's heart. Even if you don't have a spiritual master, whoever our spiritual guide is. The point is that we all need to be situated in our service to Krishna in a way that is compatible and comfortable for us. If we find ourselves in a situation that is incompatible, that is too demanding, then that itself will take a huge toll for us. And we will not be able to serve properly. So, I had in Prabhupada Memories, in that CD as well as in the book, there's a beautiful pastime of Srila Prabhupada with one of his disciples, Ishana Prabhu. when I had gone to Alachua last year, I met Ishan Prabhu and asked him about this pastime. He said that is the brightest memory. He's a very elderly devotee now. He's staying in Alachua. So he told me this is the brightest memory of my life. And this illustrates this point of bilateral relationship between the spiritual master and disciple. So when Prabhupada was in Europe, at that time England, London was the headquarters, European headquarters. And Prabhupada had so devotees from Germany, from France, from various other places had all come to London. And Prabhupada was asking each of them, so how is the preaching going on in Germany? What are the programs in France? And all of them were giving reports. But Ishan Prabhu was also there. And then he felt, you know, everybody has something to do for Srila Prabhupada, but I don't have anything to do. So after the meet darshan, other devotees went, he approached Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, you know, everyone has some service for you. Please give me some service. So Prabhupada looked at him and he says, what do you want to do for Krishna? So he said, whatever you tell me, Prabhupada, I'll do. No, Prabhupada said, what do you want to do for Krishna? He said, maybe Prabhupada is testing me. He says, whatever you want, Prabhupada, I'll do it. Prabhupada says, no, understand our philosophy. Our philosophy is to find out what we want to do and to do it for Krishna. So he said, I had never heard this before. So he said, Prabhupada, I'll have to think about it. And then he thought about it for a day or two. Then after that he came back to Prabhupada. Prabhupada, he said, that we have these mrudangas, which we have in kirtans. But many times the mrudanga falls, it cracks, it breaks, and then we have to get it all from India, from Mayapur. It becomes very difficult. So I'm thinking I'll use some material which is available here, and I'll make mrudangas here. And I'll make them such that they will not break very easily. So Prabhupada said, very good. You know, your Western God brothers are very passionate. So make the mrudanga in such a way, even if they throw it down, it should not break. So, of course, nobody should throw down a mrudanga. The point is, Prabhupada encouraged him in that way. And then he said, through that one instruction, I got lifelong service. So, yes, if the spiritual master gives us an instruction, we should consider it as a treasure and do according to that instruction. But if we don't get an instruction, that does not mean that we should wait for the future when spiritual master will give me an instruction until that time I stay passive, doing nothing. No, you know, if we keep waiting, we are waiters. We are not devotees. We have to do what we can do right now. So, in one sense, surrender means to do what we can with what we have now. To do what we can with what we have now. So we have some talent, some time, some abilities. Just use them in Krishna's service. So here, when Narad Muni sees that, Dhruva is serious. But Dhruva also says that, I cannot follow this instruction. Then Narad Muni gives Dhruva the instructions. Chant Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And he tells him how to create a place of worship in the forest. And Dhruva performs the austerities and the meditation, the devotion with such intensity that in a short time he is able to see the Supreme Lord. So Dhruva Maharaj, for him, his anger and his sense of injury and hurt, that is channeled towards Vishnu by Narad Muni. So that is Narad Muni's expertise. Narad Muni, he gives him higher level instruction first, but when he sees that it's not possible, it doesn't suit, Narad Muni gives him an appropriate level of instruction. And Dhruva becomes purified. And the success of Dhruva Maharaj is not just that he sees Vishnu. It is not even that after seeing Vishnu, he no longer has any desire for getting a kingdom. And he says, Kacham Vichinvan Api Devi Ratnam. He says, oh Lord, I came before you and you are yourself the supreme jewel. And I was looking for broken pieces of glass. That he gets this realization, yes, that is glorious, no doubt. His darshan of Vishnu is glorious. His being purified of his desire for the kingdom is also glorious. But what is even more special is, when he goes back to the kingdom, he has no animosity towards his stepmother. Nor does he have any animosity towards his stepbrother. Advaishta sarva bhutanam maitra karuna evache. In 12.13, Krishna tells in the Bhagavad Gita that, actually my devotee is a non-envious friend of everyone. So Dhruva Maharaj's heart has been completely transformed by the process of bhakti which Narad Muni gave to him. So similarly we see here Narad Muni's expertise. One is he is instructing a hunter. So yes, sometimes
we have these coaching classes, and they often advertise after 10th standard exam or 12th standard exam that, you know, so many students came in the merit list, so many students got into IIT. Yes, that is good, but if we actually look behind, most of these top coaching classes, they take top students only. You know, to get into these coaching classes, especially top coaching classes, there's a lot of competition. So, if you are already getting top students, and then they get top results, it's not all that glorious. You know, if the coaching class said that, you know, okay, this person in the 9th standard, it just got 40%. And now here 10th standard, it's got 95%. Now that is a miraculous transformation. That very few people can do that. So Narad Muni's profile, it extends over the whole gamut. On one level, he is instructing a super learned sage like Vyasadeva. On another level, he is instructing a person who is a criminal like Valyagori, who later becomes Valmiki. At another level, he is instructing a small 5-year-old boy. Now, actually, to instruct a 5-year-old boy, what is the intellectual capacity of a 5-year-old boy also? To instruct him requires a special skill, special expertise. So he has that expertise. But in the 7th canto, his compassion attains the zenith. Now, even to instruct a 5-year-old boy requires some amount of skill. But Narad Muni is so eager to preach that he doesn't even wait for a person to be born. So, even before Prahlad is born, at that time, Narad Muni starts preaching to him. And how does he... So, the backstory is that Hiranyakashipu has decided to perform austerities in order to take revenge for the killing of Hiranyaksha by Varaha. And so he goes to the mountains for performing austerities. At that time, the devatas are apprehensive that Hiranyakashipu is already a powerful demon, and his son will also be equally oppressive. So they decide to arrest Kayadhu, his wife, and they decide to keep her in prison till she delivers the child, and then after the child is delivered, they are planning to kill him. So here we see the devatas are themselves acting in quite a terrible way, that they are thinking of killing a small child, and they have arrested a woman over there. So at that time Narad Muni intervenes. And Narad Muni, he instructs that, he says that, why are you arresting her? The child in her womb is actually a great devotee. He's a Mahabhagavat. Now, Narad Muni has such respect, even among the devatas, that immediately they accept his word. And the same person whom they had arrested, you know, she was a woman, so they had not put any handcuffs around her, but she was their prisoner. At one moment she was their prisoner, and the next moment she becomes an object of veneration. The devata circumambulate her. And Kayadhu is wondering, what is happening over here? She doesn't even understand initially. Because, you know, she's a woman, she's scared, her husband is away, and somebody has come and abducted her. What is going to happen? And then she sees Narad Muni over there. Now the devatas have come and arrested her. And then suddenly the devatas, their whole attitude changes, and they are offering respects and they just go away. And she starts thinking, this Narad Muni must be a very powerful person. Those devatas, they were so powerful, and they just left on one word of Narad Muni. So how powerful he must be. She thinks that, this Narad Muni can protect me. Who knows, the devatas may come back again. If they come back and try to arrest me again, who will defend me? So she begs to Narad Muni, she says, let me stay with you. And Narad Muni is a renunciate. But he sees this as an opportunity that he can instruct Kayadhu. Now Kayadhu is not, she is there not because she has a very great devotional inclination. See, in the Vedic culture, we see that, broad Vedic culture, even the demons understand that their powers don't exist in isolation. That even they have to appease some higher beings by which they can get powers. In the Ramayana, it is described that before Ravana went for battle, you know, he had his own Brahmanas. The Brahmanas, they are called Yathudhanas. They were the Brahmanas who would serve the Rakshasas. So, normally we think of Brahmanas as people who are in Sattva Guna. But that's, yes, they are, Brahmanas, relatively speaking, in Sattva Guna.
But we know the Puranas, there are Sattvic Puranas, Rajasic Puranas, there are Tamasic Puranas. So now in the Tamasic Puranas, there are rituals which are described, for example, meat eating and other such things are described. Now these rituals, who is going to perform them? If all the Brahmanas are in Sattvaguna, who will perform those rituals? So there are some Brahmanas who also do Tamasic activities. That means Tamasic rituals they perform. So Yatudhanas are like that. So the point I am making here is that even in the Rakshasa culture, there is some respect of Brahmanas. But that is not out of any bhakti for them. That is just to treating them as a channel to some higher power. To invoke that higher power, the Brahmanas are said to know the rituals by which higher powers can be channeled, and that's why they are respected. So Kayadu also, she has that pious respect for Narad Muni. And Narad Muni tells her, hear. And she sits and hears whatever Narad Muni is speaking. But she hears and she forgets. So there is no transformation substantial that happens in her. But Narad Muni is actually not just speaking for her. Narad Muni is also speaking for Prahlad, who is in her womb. And he speaks and speaks and speaks. And Prahlad hears all of it. And Prahlad assimilates it. So there have been a lot of scientific research done about what is the extent of the prenatal cognitive ability in infants. Prenatal means before the birth. What is the cognitive ability? How much can children understand? And there have been well-documented researches done which show at the very least that, so for example, there are Dr. Ian Stevenson is one of the most famous researchers in past life memories. So he did some interesting research that if the mother sees some violent stimuli when she is pregnant, so for example, if she sees a burning fire and she is emotionally scarred by that burning fire, then quite often that translates as a scar on the body of the infant. And usually if a child is born with some problems, then the cause can be traced. If there is no genetic cause, then there has to be some systemic cause. That means either there is some biochemical imbalance in the mother's womb because of which the problem has come. And if that is also not a problem, so the child in the womb is in a very protected environment. If it is having any problems, where do the problems come from? Either they can come from the genes or they can come from the environment, which is the womb of the mother. So if from neither the problems are coming, then where are the problems coming from? That means at a psychological level, the thoughts of the mother create an impression on the child. Now how this happens, the mainstream modern science may not be able to understand it right now, because it focuses largely on gross material phenomena. So anyway, Narad Muni speaks and Prahlad hears, Prahlad understands. And how much does Prahlad understand? When we think about spiritual knowledge, we talk about, we should always remember Krishna. Yes, we should remember Krishna, but remembering Krishna is not just a matter of intellectual recollection. It is a matter of devotional redirection. It is not a matter of intellectual recollection means, yes, it is not like some children, you know, okay, 3 threes are 9, 3 fours are 12, 3 fives are 15. Yeah, that is a mathematical table children can repeat. So remembrance of Krishna is not a matter of intellectual recollection. When we talk about we should remember Krishna, what it means is it's a matter of redirection of the heart. That when we are attached to something, when we are captivated by something, that we naturally remember that thing. Suppose, you know, some cricket World Cup is coming and there's cricket mania everywhere. Sometimes you may see some young men are walking along the ground and they are moving their hands, you know, as if they are the next Sachin Tendulkar going to hit a bat winning six. So, you know, they are on the road walking along, but their minds are in the cricket field. So this is what their heart is attached to that. So when Krishna is saying, always remember me, yes, initially we do make a conscious exercise to try to remember Krishna. But it is not just intellectual or mechanical recollection. It is actually devotional redirection that God is asked for. And this is what happens to Prahlad Maharaj. So now, later on we will see the Prahlad pastime. It actually goes on, it starts from around the fifth chapter. From the first chapter of the seventh canto itself, this narrative starts. But Prahlad Maharaj appears in the fifth canto. And then fifth chapter onwards, fifth, sixth chapter, it goes on. So his instructions to his activities and his instructions to his schoolmates are described in seven chapters, six, seven chapters. And eighth chapter, Hiranyakashipu Narasimhadev appears and kills Hiranyakashipu. And ninth chapter, Prahlad Maharaj's prayers. So, I was talking about how the greatness of a teacher is understood not just through the greatness of the student. That is one way of understanding the greatness of the student. How great a student becomes, through that we can understand the greatness of the teacher. Another way is how great is the transformation that the teacher brings in the student from here to take him to the here. So, it is said that the ideal guru-disciple relationship is the disciple never thinks that I have become better than the guru. But the guru's greatest joy is when the disciple becomes greater than the guru. So, when some devotee asks, Shyamananda Prabhu often tells this pastime that one devotee asked Srila Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, Bhaktivinoda Thakur preached in Bengal, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur preached in India, you preached all over the world, therefore you are greater than all of them. Prabhupada said, you should never think like this. He says, what I have achieved is by their mercy. By their mercy I have achieved this. He says, oh, similarly, but still we see that Prabhupada achieved a lot. So we will see in this pastime, Narad Muni's success is what, within the Leela of this pastime, Prahlad becomes greater than Narad Muni. In what sense? It is, so Narad, actually the seventh, the Bhagavatam is, I was talking about nested conversations, you know, one conversation with another conversation with another conversation. So this seventh canto is one of the high level nestings. So the conversation between Sukhdev Goswami and Shaunakrishi, then it is a conversation between Parikshit Maharaj and Sukhdev Goswami, then that's starting from the second canto. Seventh canto is the conversation between Yudhishthir Maharaj and Narad Muni. So Narad Muni is himself speaking about how he rescued Prahlad and how he instructed Prahlad. The whole story is being told within that. So now this is a fourth level narrative that is going on. So in this fourth level narrative, what happens is Narad Muni is describing that Hiranyakashipu's glory was so great, Hiranyakashipu's prowess was so great, that not only all the devatas bowed down to him, but he said sages like me also had to bow down to him. Now we may wonder, why would Narad Muni have to bow down to him? Narad Muni did not bow down to Ravana. Why did Narad Muni here bow down to Hiranyakashipu? So every pastime has a particular rasa, and every pastime has a particular purpose. So within that leela, for increasing that rasa, for fulfilling that purpose, the Lord arranges for the various characters to act in particular ways. So for example, in the Draupadi Vastraharan leela, Bhishma could have intervened, Vidura could have intervened, the Pandavas could have said to, I don't care about my word, I'll just stop. I will stop Draupadi. But the point is, this whole pastime, this mood is to demonstrate the glory of the devotion of Draupadi and the glory of the Lord's protection. So all the other characters, consciously or subconsciously, they act in particular ways by which the purpose of the pastime is fulfilled. So similarly, it is not that Narad Muni was afraid of his life, Narad Muni was thinking that, oh, Hiranyakashipu will kill me, therefore let me bow down to him. No. Narad Muni understood that this pastime, the whole purpose of this pastime is to glorify Prahlad. So therefore, the point it makes is that everybody in the universe bowed down to Hiranyakashipu. Even Narad Muni says, I myself bowed down to Hiranyakashipu. But Prahlad did not bow down. Prahlad did not bow down. Such is the glory of Prahlad. How great is his devotion. Such total transformation. For the devatas, actually they had their own abodes. They could just go and stay over there, or they could flee anywhere. Prahlad is a 5-year-old boy. So where will he go? He doesn't even, is at that time practically he has not even gone out of his kingdom. So he has to stay over there, that is where his home is. And while being in that home, he is disobeying his father. Now he disobeys his father, but his mood is not disobedient or arrogant. He says to, when Hiranyakashipu asks him, Hiranyakashipu, this is the 8th chapter, the beginning, he says, Hiranyakashipu says that, no, just by my raising of the eyebrows,
even the devatas start trembling. And you, how is it that you are not trembling at all? I'm shouting at you. So now, normally, you know, if we see some big bodybuilder kind of person and some other very thin, skinny person, and this thin, skinny person is standing fearlessly in front of the bodybuilder, you think, iske piche koi hona chahiye. You know, somebody must be there with him. Otherwise, aise zurut kaise karna hai? How does he have this courage? So that's the question that Hiranyakashipu asks. Hiranyakashipu asks, he says, by whose power are you able to defy me like this? So now, you know, sometimes people may think that God is the best of all beings. You know, there is this, I am so powerful, he's that powerful, he's that powerful, he's that powerful. There's a hierarchy, and top of that hierarchy is God. God is the best of all beings. Now, at one level, this understanding is okay. But if we have only this understanding of God, that God is the best among all beings, then we may think, okay, if somebody else becomes the best, then God can be replaced. Just like there's tennis, there are players, and there's one person who is number one, because that person has the maximum number of points now. So if somebody else gets the maximum number of points, then number one will be displaced. So if we think that God is the best of all beings, then we may think that God is replaceable. So God is not just the best of all beings. He is the basis of all being. He is the basis of all being. He says, Yachapi sarva bhutanam bijam tadatma arjuna natadasti vinayatsyan maya bhutam characharam. Krishna says, nothing can exist without me. And that is what Prahlad Maharaj tells Hiranyakashipu, that actually you are asking about the source of my power. I will tell you the source of everyone's power, including your power also. And don't think that there is a hierarchy in which, or there is someone bigger than you, and if you become big enough, you will knock him down. Don't have that conception of Vishnu. Vishnu is not just the top of hierarchy. He is the basis of all being. He is the source of the strength of everyone. At one level, this might seem like provocation. It's like you go in a lion's den and then twirl, pull its moustache. Why is Prahlad doing like this? Is he provoking? Is he has got a death wish on his head that he is provoking Hiranyakashipu like this? No. The point is, Prahlad is trying in his own small capacity to educate Hiranyakashipu, to make him see sense. If you see the whole flow of verses, it's very beautiful. And the next point, not the later verse, what does Prahlad say? That he says, you are saying Vishnu is your enemy. Actually, you have no enemies. The only enemy is your uncontrolled and misdirected mind. Beautiful adjectives for describing. Uncontrolled, it's not just uncontrolled, but it is misdirected also. Therefore, he says, learn to control the mind, and then you will see that Vishnu is not your enemy. So he's trying to tell his father that don't think I have become a defector. You are thinking that I have become a traitor, that I have sided on the side of your enemy. But no, I have not sided on the side of your enemy, because Vishnu is not your enemy. Vishnu is the basis of all of our existence. So the point is, this is that Prahlad can speak such profound philosophy at the age of 5. This is the glory of Narad Muni. This is the greatness of Narad Muni, by which he has been able to inculcate such values. So it's not that when Prahlad tells his schoolmates ask, where did you learn all this? You know, our teachers never taught us these things. And you know, our parents will also not taught us these things. How did you learn this? He says that I learned it from Narad Muni. He says, when did you meet Narad Muni? So he says, I never met him. But how did you learn from him? He says, I heard when I was in my mother's womb. They are impressed by that. How did you hear when we don't even know what we were doing when you were in mother's womb? But, so now the point which I am making is that it is not that Prahlad just is doing rote repetition over here. No, he heard, he assimilated, he understood, and now he is repeating with assimilation and realization. So remembrance is not just intellectual or mechanical recollection. It is devotional redirection. So Narad Muni's success is that Prahlad Maharaj's heart is completely redirected in utter fearlessness. And even in the face of death, he is able to have this jnana chakshu, this prema chakshu, the eyes of knowledge, the eyes of devotion. And he is able to, even after his father tries to assassinate him, what does he do? He begs for the Lord's mercy on his father. He begs Hiranyakashipu that Hiranyakashipu be forgiven. And Narasimhadev is so pleased and blesses him. So that is the success of Narad Muni. And then if we move to the 10th canto, Narad Muni comes in the 10th canto at several places. I'll talk about two places, one from the Bhagavatam and one from Gopal Champu, with which I'll then move to the conclusion of the class. So in the 10th canto, first he appears in the... when Kamsa is going along his chariot, and he is taking his chariot, driving Devaki and Vasudeva's chariot. At that time, the Akashvani comes along. And when the Akashvani comes, at that time, his complete mentality change. He is about to kill Devaki. And Vasudeva talks in the emergency action. He pacifies him. Tells him, I'll give all your sons, all my sons. You are afraid of my sons. Why should you let Devaki die? Why should you kill Devaki? So now, here, I was asked this question on my website. He said, you know, if Kamsa was afraid of the son of Vasudeva and Devaki killing him, why did he keep them in the same cell? He could just have kept them in separate cells, there would be no son. So now, the point is, if you look at Kamsa's mentality, Kamsa, he was a demon. And a demon doesn't mean that he'll... Vishnu Bhakta Smrito Deva Asuras Tad Viparyaya. The Asuras, they want to go against not just Vishnu, but against the whole cosmic order. So, Kamsa, it was not just because of the goodness of his heart that when Vasudev said that, oh, why do you want to kill Devaki? I'll give her sons to you. So it was not because of the goodness of his heart that he abandoned his plan to kill Devaki. He thought that I will prove the Akashvani to be wrong. He says, if the son of Devaki is going to kill me, by killing him, by killing the one who is supposed to be my killer, you know, I will prove the Devatas to be wrong. And when I prove the Devatas to be wrong, when I prove the Akashvani to be wrong, then my glory will be enhanced by that. So, it was his foolhardy arrogance, because of which he allowed Devaki and Vasudeva to stay together, and he allowed them to beget children. And his idea was, he did not even try to kill the womb, because he said, let the child be born. After he is born, I'll kill him. And this way, I will prove who is going to kill me. I have killed my killer. So, he had this mentality. Now, what happens is, the first child, who is Kirtivan, is brought by Vasudev to Kamsa. Because Devaki is in tears. Vasudev, he conceals his tears, controls himself and takes him. And Kamsa is very pleased. He says, oh, you are so truthful. He says, anyway, I am actually afraid of the 8th son only. So you can take him back. There's no problem. Now, when he does this, at that time, Narad Muni comes there. And Narad Muni tells him, so according to later retellings of this Krishna Lila, Narad Muni brings a flower petal to him. And he says, which is the 8th? Which is the 8th petal over here? 1, 2, 3. He says, 8th? You don't know. See, the devatas are very dhurta. These devatas are very cunning. They may say the 8th son will kill, but who knows, the first son may also kill. So, now at this point, Kamsa becomes very furious. Fearful and furious. And he decided that better lot will not take any chances. And he kills all the sons, one by one by one. Now we may say that, is Narad Muni responsible for this? That Kamsa, he would not have killed Devaki's son, but Narad Muni acted, because of Narad Muni's provocation, Kamsa killed. Actually, it's not as simple. There are multiple things going on over here. The 6 sons, I can't go into the backstory, most of you probably know the story also. The 6 sons were higher beings. They were the sons of Maricha, who was the son of Brahma, who had been cursed to be born on the earth. And the quicker their lifespan on the earth, the quicker they would be go back to their heaven, they would be to go back to the heavenly residence. So that was one purpose. Another was that by killing those sons, Kamsa would be increasing his power.
and the reaction of as he increases his sin more and more, the reaction will come faster. Thirdly is that if they don't have children, if Vasudeva and Devaki, they have a child and they have to take care of the child, and they will let the child grow a little bit, and after some years they may beget the next child. But if they don't have a child, then they will beget the next child quickly. So the idea was Narad Muni wanted Krishna to appear as fast as possible so that Kamsa's atrocities would be ended as fast as possible. So when he is acting, he is not just provoking Kamsa for just fun's sake or provocation's sake. So Narad Muni is not Kalha Priya, he is Krishna Priya. He wants Krishna to appear as quickly as possible. And for causing the appearance of Krishna, if Kalha has to be done, he will do Kalha also. But the point is, his love is for Krishna, it's not to create conflict. Now, interestingly, Narad Muni appears many times, but Narad Muni appears once very significantly when Krishna is in Vrindavan and is just about to depart from Vrindavan. So at that time, this is described in Gopal Champu, and Jiva Goswami gives a very beautiful analysis of Krishna's pastimes in the 10th canto in Gopal Champu, and he states over there that when Narad Muni appears, we will see that Narad Muni at that time tells Krishna, "Hey Krishna, in the future, now you are here, now you will see, I will see you, you will go to Mathura and you will kill Kuvalya, the elephant Kuvalyapida, you will kill the demons and then you will destroy Kamsa. And then you will build Dwarka." He tells the whole 10th canto in advance. And sometimes if we want to go and watch a movie, and then somebody tells, "Hey, this movie is so nice, I'll tell you the story." "Hey, don't tell me the story, I want to go and watch it. You will kill the suspense." In Krishna Leela, it is, we may say, Narad Muni, if he already knows the whole story, then what is the joy in it? Actually, once there is love for Krishna, the joy is not just in the new information. It is in the new recollection. Whenever, even if the same story is told, it triggers newer and deeper recollections. So at that time, Narad Muni, Krishna has not yet made a plan to depart from Vrindavan. But Krishna is in, and Narad Muni tells him that you are living here and you are performing pastimes, and whichever demons are coming here, you are killing them. But the rest of the world is still populated by demons. And you have a duty to go there. And you have to kill those demons. And Krishna's heart is not ready to go. He says, "How can I leave my Vrajavasis? How can I bear separation from them? How can they bear separation from me? I cannot go." But Narad Muni tells him, "Oh Lord, you have descended at the plea of the Devatas for the sake of doing good to the world. You have done good to the world by demonstrating the pastimes of Raja. But that is not the only purpose of your descent. You also have to establish order in this world. So please, O Lord, whatever you desire, you may do." But Krishna is a small child and is in that role of a small child. Krishna understands that Narad Muni actually instructed him now. So he decides to go. And actually when Krishna goes away from Vrindavan, what does he do? Again, Narad Muni knows what is going to happen. So Nakrura comes along and Krishna gets separated from the gopis. But here what happens is, Narad Muni inspires Krishna and the gopi. By inspiring Krishna to leave Vrindavan, he enables them all to experience love in separation. So, in the Narad Bhakti Sutra also, this bhakti is analyzed very beautifully, very coherently. And intense recollection is the essence of devotion. Intense recollection. That is one of the definitions of bhakti given in Narad Bhakti Sutra. And normally, if the person whom we love is present, there is some recollection. But when the person is not present, at that time, the recollection often becomes intensified. So the example is given that separation is to love what wind is to fire. Now fire is burning somewhere and then a wind starts blowing. If there is a forest fire, if some forest fire occurs, and if at that time a big wind also comes, that is a firefighter's nightmare. Because that wind will cause the fire to spread more and more. So like that, in the devotees, for the devotee, there is like a fire of love for Krishna in the heart. And when separation is there, separation acts like the wind. And that wind causes the fire to grow more and more and more. the devotee's recollection of Krishna becomes more and more and more. And actually, ultimately, Krishna is not hard-hearted. Krishna is not leaving his devotees. Even when Lord Ram, when he separates Sita from himself, it is not just because of his reputation. It is ultimately Ram and Sita, they are both experiencing love in separation. So, Naramuni plays a pivotal role in enabling this love and separation to be experienced by both Krishna and the Vraja devotees. Now, of course, we have to know that this metaphor works both ways. That there is fire and there is wind. You know, if the fire is big, the wind will increase the fire. If the fire is just a candle, the wind will extinguish it. So, we should not think, I'll become separated from devotees, my love will increase. Our love is like, currently our bhakti is like a small candle. If we go away from devotees, the winds will come and they'll extinguish the devotion. So we need association. But at a very advanced stage, when Krishna's presence is alive and active in our heart, then when externally we are separated from the manifestations of Krishna, then the flame of devotion burns brighter and bigger and intensifies our devotion. So Narad Muni is the person who causes the manifestation of Krishna and his wonderful pastimes in various places, throughout the universes, in various ages. And Narad Muni is especially known for traveling here and there, everywhere, wherever Krishna's pastimes are having a dramatic turn, Narad Muni will appear there. And he will make the dramatic turn even more dramatic. And that missionary zeal of traveling far and wide, that was also manifested in Srila Prabhupada. So Srila Prabhupada had in one sense both the missionary zeal of traveling that Narad Muni had and also the literary zeal of writing that Vyasadeva had. So both he combined together. You know, for I am a writer and when I start traveling I just can't write much because you need a particular set of framework and things like that to write. But Prabhupada was always traveling. And yet he was always writing. How he did that and how he wrote so much and such deep stuff, that is phenomenal. And Prabhupada traveled. You know, in the last 10-11 years of his life, he went around the world, not once, not twice, 14 times, round and round, and constantly traveling. So what was it that made him travel? Sometimes, you know, when people are very much tortured by desires, by lust, by greed, by anger, then because of that they are not able to sleep, they are not able to eat, they are not able to do anything, the desire is burning them. So Prabhupada's heart was burning with compassion. And that compassion did not let him rest. He would just sleep for a few hours and he would wake up and he would start writing. So all day he would be talking about Krishna to people who came to meet him. And all night he would be talking about Krishna to people who did not come to meet him by writing books for them. In this way, he traveled far and wide. He went to practically all the inhabited continents of the world. For the 50th anniversary, I have written a small book called Prabhupada, The Moments That Made the Moment. So in that book, I've described how Prabhupada went to all the 5 continents. He went from here to America, and from America to Europe, from Europe to USSR. Then, of course, he came to India, then he went to Australia, then he went to Africa, then he went to South America. You know, he would have gone to Antarctica also, but people were not there in Antarctica. So, Prabhupada traveled all over the world. And the way he traveled was, wherever he went, he just filled people over there with spiritual memories, with spiritual energy, with spiritual inspiration to share Krishna Bhakti. Not only practice it themselves, but to share it with everyone. So that missionary zeal, Prabhupada said that he had got the special blessings of the previous acharyas. When he had been in Vrindavan, at that time he had prayed to the previous acharyas. And of course, in a distant way, one of the previous acharyas was also Narad Muni. So Narad Muni is not just a historical character who lived long time ago. Yes, he is definitely a person who lived long time ago. He's a person who is a great character. But that spirit that Narad Muni embodied, spirit of selfless, tireless devotion, that Srila Prabhupada also embodied. And through his example, by meditating on how Narad Muni so extraordinarily practiced and shared bhakti, we can pray to him. We can beg his blessings and get his mercy, by which we can also be inspired in his bhakti. There is one shloka which comes repeatedly, twice in the Mahabharata and once in the Bhagavatam. And that is, and the theme is basically, when Yudhishthira is talking with Yaksha, the Yaksha asks, Kaha Pantha, what path should one follow? And at that time, Yudhishthira replies, Mahajano Yena Gataha Sapantha. The path that we should follow is the path given by the Mahajanas. So, the path is not just a straight physical path. The path is a path of an example which they have given. So, we, by meditating on, by praying to, and by internalizing the example of the great Mahajanas like Narad Muni, we can also be inspired in our devotion, we can be instructed in our devotion, we can be enlivened in our devotion, and march onwards in our journey, going closer to Krishna ourselves, and helping others to come close to Krishna. Thank you very much. Narad Muni ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you very much. Do we have time for any questions? Does anyone have any questions?
Yeah. Raj Parikshit Prabhu.
Can speak. Okay. The question is that if we are chanting, that we said we should use our intelligence in chanting, but then how do we rise from intellectual recollection to devotional redirection in our remembrance of Krishna? It happens gradually through purification. So, purification is not something abstract. Purification simply means that we all have various kinds of attachments now. There are some things within the, if you consider Krishna Bhakti to be a circle, within Krishna Bhakti we have certain likes. And outside Krishna Bhakti also we have certain likes. Some of those likes may be non-devotional and some of those likes may be anti-devotional. So, non-devotional may not be so harmful, anti-devotional are quite harmful. So, when we become purified, that means our likes which are within the circle of devotion, they become strengthened. And the likes which are outside the circle of devotion, they become weakened. So, certainly at this stage, even if we are doing intellectual recollection, that is very good. Say for example, if we use our intelligence to remember that I should remember Krishna. And we try to focus our mind on the holy name, we try to recite verses, we take darshan of the deities. At our stage, the operational principle is, yena kena prakarena, mana Krishna nivesha. Somehow or the other fix the mind on Krishna. So, the wonderful thing about Krishna is not just that he is the goal of devotion, he is also the path to devotion. That means it's not that Krishna is present at the end of our journey. Now suppose, say if you are going to America to meet some VIP and you are sitting in your plane and you go there and you are eagerly waiting and finally you reach there and you knock on the door and the door opens and you see that the person who is opening the door was the person who was sitting right next to you in your same airplane throughout your journey. But because you did not know that person, so you did not talk with him, you did not understand him. But when you reach the destination, oh, this is the same person. So like that, Krishna is not just our destination, he is also our companion. So Krishna is right now there with us. When we chant the holy names, when we take darshan of the deities, he's there. And we don't realize it right now. But even if somehow or the other, we fix our mind on Krishna, that will purify us and that will increase our attraction to Him. So at an intellectual level, we can increase our attraction to Krishna by studying scripture and understanding intellectually how everything apart from Krishna is insubstantial. But bhakti sanjayate bhakti. Devotion comes by associating with devotees, especially. So if, of course, even when we are studying Shastra, if we see it, we are associating with Prabhupada, we are associating with Narad Muni, we are associating with Shukadeva Goswami. If we study scripture in the mood of associating with these great sages, that will purify us. So association with those who have devotion to Krishna is very important for the redirection of the heart. And in that sense, our desires are not just linear. They are triangular. Linear means, you know, if I see a sense object and I start desiring that object. So that is linear desire. But quite often, suppose say I go to America, a student from India goes to America. Now America, India people are mad for cricket. America people are mad for baseball. Now Indians may not even know what is baseball. But after going to America and seeing everyone mad for baseball, what happens when first somebody goes and sees baseball? What is going on? But then you see people cheering and people going mad. What happens? After 1 or 2 months, this Indian also becomes mad. So what has happened? That desire for baseball has not come just by watching the baseball. It has come by watching those who are watching baseball. So the desire is not just linear, it is triangular. So between us, the object, and the people who are attracted to that object. And this triangularity of desire is very important to understand when you are practicing bhakti. So just when we come in front of the deities, we say, okay, very nicely decorated idols are there here. Or we study the Bhagavad Gita, okay, this is good, some Sanskrit book. But when we actually associate with those who are devoted to the deities, we associate with those who are relishing the Bhagavad Gita, relishing the Bhagavatam, then by seeing their attraction to scripture, our attraction to scripture will develop. So that's why for the redirection of the heart, it's vital to associate with those whose hearts is redirected towards Krishna. And it is also, anyway, we keep the mind fixed on Krishna, He will purify us, and gradually, by intellectual recollection, gradually, if we keep practicing it in a mood of devotion, in a mood of service to Krishna, that devotional redirection will also happen gradually. So it's like the sun rising. You know, we may not see it happening automatically. Every morning when we wake up, we say it's night, it's dawn, and then suddenly, oh, the sun has risen. Now the sun's rise is gradual, but our realization that the sun has risen is at a particular moment. So like that, you know, every day that we are chanting, every day that we are practicing bhakti, the sun of Krishna is rising in our heart. Our heart is becoming more and more redirected towards Him. But one day we'll realize, oh, this was an object I was so attached to, but now I don't feel an attachment. Now my heart is attracted towards Krishna. So we shouldn't expect any overnight miracles, but we just keep practicing bhakti steadily, trying to fix our mind in Krishna in whatever way is practical for us, and associating with those whose heart is directed towards Krishna. And gradually, that devotional redirection of the heart will also happen. Thank you. Any other question?
Because, Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
Because what I was contemplating about comparing Narada and Shakuni, both are creating conflicts. So it is the major difference between Narad Muni and Shakuni is explained in terms of difference between gangster and surgeon. So would you like to comment on this?
Okay. So Narad Muni and Shakuni both seem to create conflict. So what is the difference between the two? Yeah, it is primarily in terms of intent. You know, why are we doing a particular thing? So that way we can say in the Mahabharata, classic example is there, that Arjuna is shooting arrows, Duryodhana is shooting arrows. But there is a world of difference in consciousness, in motivation, in intention. So Narad Muni, whatever he is doing it for the service of the Lord. Whereas Shakuni is doing it for his own interests. Shakuni actually There are multiple stories told in the background, but the primary reason was that when Bhishma came to seek the hand of the Gandhar princes for the Kuru king, at that time he expected that Gandhari will get married, will be married to Pandu, because Pandu was going to be the king. And Bhishma thought that he had approached first, so in a family, first the older brother gets married, then the younger brother gets married. And Gandhari was first approached, so he had Gandhari married to Dhritarashtra. And Shakunaya had his own political purposes. He thought that if my sister is the queen of the Kuru dynasty, then my power and my position will increase. And because of that, when he saw that she was married to Dhritarashtra, not to Pandu, he felt that he and his own dynasty had been slighted. Now Gandhari accepted it gracefully. Now the hunger for power is such that Shakuni got angry, Gandhari was not angry. Gandhari accepted. And because of that grudge, and that became a burning resentment, and he felt that I will topple and destroy those who are dear to Bhishma. And in that way, I will take revenge. And he wanted to get Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra to grab power, so that he would have power. So Shakuni's manipulations were motivated by anger and selfishness, whereas Narad Muni's, whatever he does, that is actually inspired by the Lord for the sake of the service of the Lord and for the sake of doing good to all. So there's a world of difference between the two. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. La Prabhupada ki. Hare Krishna. Thank you.